this week on Potlatch, Dave Hendrickson of Nunavak Island, Tim Wallace of Fort Yukon, and some Alaskan Eskimo songs and stories. Potlatch, a program about Alaska Natives for Alaska Natives. Several weeks ago, we had Dave Hendrickson here giving some information concerning second-class cities and unorganized boroughs. Today, we have Dave Hendrickson to tell us about his work.
My job with the Extension Service is in the area of local government, special program in Extension Service.
What kinds of services do you perform for the villages in Alaska?
Well, our role is that of strictly of an educational effort, and that effort is focused to our elected officials in second-class cities across the state.
The first-class city, what does that mean?
You might say that our special interest is in the second-class cities. However, there is a difference between the two, and that is the first-class city or any second-class city that desires to be first-class city status has to have at least 400 people. As in a second-class city, all it requires is 25 people.
How do the responsibilities for people in a first-class city differ from the responsibilities of a second-class city?
In the first-class city, the mandatory things that the state law says that the first-class city has to have is mainly the educational one. That is, they would have to operate their schools within that city. As in a second-class city, they don't have no mandate by law to operate their schools. That's the major difference.
What are some of the responsibilities and privileges of a second-class city?
Well, the second-class cities don't have to have powers. That is up to each elected council in that city. By adopting ordinances, they can have these powers. But on the other hand, they essentially don't have any powers if they don't adopt ordinances that the law allows them. So they can stand as a virtually as before. However, by becoming a city, or if they have become a city, the law allows them the powers that they can adopt to exercise.
And what are some of these powers?
Some of these powers are, for instance, they can zone the city. They have that power. They don't have to. They can have sales tax from 1% to 3%. They can have the sales tax and use tax. Then again, they don't have to have it. See, the law allows them these powers. However, they are not forced upon them. They can have a policeman in that city. The law, state law, allows them this. So it all would depend on each elected council in each second-class city, just how much power that they want to exercise.
And fire departments, this would be another power?
Right. That's one of the areas that they can exercise by having volunteer fire department in that city. However, we can have volunteer fire departments in villages, that in traditional villages. That's one of the things that the state law allows. Another thing, Jeff, that we ought to mention here is if the first class city or a second class city is located within a borough, then the borough assumes the educational responsibility. So in an event, city of Fairbanks, which is home rule, first class, I believe, the borough assumes the educational responsibility. That's the state law.
Does that borough have to be an organized borough, or can it also be an unorganized borough?
Well, there's a difference between organized and unorganized borough. The unorganized borough is in areas where there are no boroughs, and the assemblymen, so-called assemblymen, are our legislatures, elected legislature, who act more or less as assemblymen in unorganized borough.
You here working in an office from 8 to 5, do you have 8 to 5 hours when you go out into the field?
No. Sometimes I work 10, 16 hours out in the field. It all depends what has to be done out there.
What kinds of services do you provide when you get the opportunity to go out into the field?
When we go out to the field, which has been rare of late, we, like I said before, we provide educational portion, which is not being done by...
So you go out and give talks to people?
Right.
Do you show...
Presentations. Presentations in workshops. We have been Department of Community and Regional Affairs and, of course, my department have been doing workshops together past 2 years. So we do work with Department of Community and Regional Affairs, which is a state function that caters to all municipalities across the state.
Dave Hendrickson, Cooperative Extension Service, University of Alaska. Dave Hendrickson, formerly of Nunavak Island. Coming next on Potlatch, some games and songs. The Eskimos have had many games and sports, including storytelling competitions, song contests, jumping, wrestling, kicking, and racing. Eskimo children particularly favor a game of teeter-totter, played by placing a board across a low fulcrum and jumping on the ends of it. Basketball is popular both indoors and outdoors. Team games such as throwing clods of loose tundra and just stomping in the spring thaw mud are typical of the creative play of contemporary young Eskimo children. The Eskimo high kick is an exciting jumping contest depending only on skill and available materials. A leather ball firmly placed with caribou hair suspended by a rope from a high framework or rafter. The contestant must jump with both feet together off the ground and touch the ball with both feet. The ball is elevated higher and higher until it can no longer be touched. A skilled jumper can touch a ball hung higher than his own head. Song contests often take the form of ridiculing one's joking partner. The joking partners are frequently cousins or distant relatives residing in different villages, or partners selected from one's own village for gift exchanges and other manifestations of friendship. Two of the singers who contributed to this collection of folk music, Mike Milligrock of Little Diomede Island and Jimmy Kilagivuk of Point Hope, were joking partners for many years. The partnership resulted in some amusing songs, one of which Kilagivuk has named his reindeer, Milligrock. Another round of joking songs with several other Diomede partners ended in some unpleasantness for Kilagivuk. He recited in song the charms of the girls from Kivalina, Noatak, Kobuk, and Selawik, but claimed that the little Diomede girls are without eyebrows, without chins, and have big mustaches. His joking partners became angry at this slur on little Diomede phenonymity. Ridiculing in songs and sometimes served the much more serious purpose of settling disputes. Judgment in civil grievances was often rendered through a contest of insults and song engaged in by the disputants. The winner was considered the innocent party. Another form of ridicule song intended solely for amusement is the juggling song, sung only by women. Juggling songs, which accompany the game of juggling beach rocks, are widely known along the coast of Alaska from St. Michael north and occur in many variants. The text includes passages and phrases and words that are different to translate, possibly because they are archaic or nonsensical. The song refers to a woman's lack of physical attraction for her husband and concludes with crude remarks about their relationship. Because of the nature of its text, the juggling song is considered indelicate, if not immoral, by contemporary Eskimo women who have been influenced by the Christian concept of morality. As one informant said, "I have shame for this song." Therefore, the women are somewhat reluctant to perform the song in public or even to admit they know it. John Murdoch, who observed a performance of the song in 1887, wrote, "I never succeeded in catching the words of this chant, which are uttered with considerable rapidity and do not appear to be ordinary words. Some of the songs are certainly indelicate to judge from the unequivocal gestures by which I saw them accompanied." Of the many versions of the marble juggling song, the following one, sung by Thora Katagog and recorded at Unalakleet, is one of the best. We hear now the women's juggling song. Another type of game for which there are accompanying songs is the string figure or cat's cradle. The Eskimos are very clever at making string figures that can be moved by drawing the strings taut and then releasing them. Most of these figures have an accompanying song and story. Some of them are merely amusing, for example, the fox chasing and catching the rabbit. Others are intended to teach manners or morals to the children. One of the latter, sung by Hazel Omwadi of St. Lawrence Island, is a reminder to children to obey their parents. The string figure shows a young girl who refuses to obey when her mother asks her to prepare the evening meal. She also refuses to obey her father when he asks her to obey her mother. But when Grandpa speaks, she jumps to do his bidding. We hear now the string game song.
I am
Two interesting songs sung by Wesley Acock accompany a Wainwright string game. While the songs are being sung, the player twists, in time to the music, a long sinew string which is looped around his foot. The string must be completely twisted by the time he finishes the first song. It is then untwisted, in time to the second song. Considerable skill is required to twist and untwist the sinew in exact time to the song. The game and the two following songs are very old. We hear now song for winding string, and then the song for unwinding string.
Yeah,
At the successful conclusion of the whale hunt, an important traditional celebration, the Nuklukatuk, is held. The Eskimos used to believe that the whale's spirit should be appeased by a special ceremony in its honor. And for many Eskimos, the appeasement of the sea mammal's soul is still an important rite. The Nuklukatuk is also given as a victory celebration in honor of the whale and the whaling crews. The whale is cut up and distributed first to the crew of hunters who helped the Umialik, then to members of other boat crews who had assisted in the kill, and finally to the rest of the people in the village. After a day or two of feasting, games, races, and dancing, the festival ends with a very special event, the blanket toss, which in the old days was accompanied always by a drum song, the Nelukatown. A very large blanket made of walrus or bearded seal skins with rope handles along the edge is pulled taut to toss a contestant high into the air. The contestant tries to land on his feet on the blanket each time he is tossed. While he is on the blanket, his friends make humorous remarks and sing ridicule songs, trying to make him laugh or embarrass him so much that he will lose his balance and the contest. Following is a very old Nelukatown that was composed for the Nelukatuk by the shaman. It is sung by Paul Green of Kotzebue and Nome. Note the melodic pattern of measures 6 through 8, which suggests the flight of the contestant as he is tossed 20 or more feet in the air. The words of this Nelukatown are, "Why is that crow or raven hollering on the riverbank?" The singer is reminding the contestant that he should look out across the horizon for the hollering raven. If he looks out, he may keep his balance. If he looks down, he will surely fall. According to legend from Point Hope and Kotzebue, where this Nelukatown originated, it was the raven that gave the Eskimos the Nelukatuk, and the raven is mentioned in several of the traditional blanket toss songs. Here now is the Nelukatown, or blanket toss song. That was the Nelukatown, or blanket toss song. Our thanks to Lorraine Caranda, the Alaska Festival of Music, and the University of Washington Press for allowing us to use this music and the text on Potlatch. Coming next, an interview with Tim Wallace of Fort Yukon and head of the DNH Corporation. Here is Tim Wallace.
The DNH Development Corporation was set up in 1969 by the Tanana Chiefs Conference, and it was basically set up to go into the construction field, which it's now in. And the prime purpose was to take advantage of any contracting that may develop locally and within our own ranks and also on the pipeline. And the position has been, or the policy has been, was to create employment or get employment for the stockholders and get them into the contracting field so they could become involved within construction, within the unions, and be able to go to work for any other contractor.
How does the DNH Development Corporation differ from Doyon?
Well, the big difference, although we're both profit-making corporations, Doyon was created by the Land Claims Settlement Act and are the recipients of the land claims funds. And their role is to implement the land claim settlement in land selections and also the distribution of funds. And DNH does not receive any money and has basically grown up on its own through borrowing of money, through a grant, and also till it got on its feet, then got involved in small contracts and has slowly built itself up.
Do DNH Development Corporation and Doyon compete in any way?
Not at the present time. We don't compete in any way at all. But the only thing we would compete in would be management personnel, which we haven't done as yet.
Let's talk in general about power for Alaska Natives, political power. Is there political power, and how do you go about getting it?
Well, certainly, any time you hold a percentage of the vote, right now it's in the neighborhood of between 20 and 25%. The first part that you have to do is through education of the Native community as a whole, realizing that the power they do have through their vote. And I think it's a matter of how you utilize the power that is of importance. I think with the increase population that we will have and are experiencing now, the percentage of the vote that we do have will decrease. And so it's a matter of education, and it's a matter of utilization of your power. I'm not a radical. I believe in getting along with everybody, and I have to date. Looking at both sides of the views and compromising. I think with a little give and take from everybody, it would be a lot better world rather than trying to segregate through politics or through economics various groups. I think we have to look at each individual as an individual, you know, rather than a race. But there certainly is the position now amongst the Native groups to become a great influence. And through, although we are going to decline with the increased population in the percentage of votes we will have, I think there's also a good possibility with the land claim settlement where we'll become a economic influence. And any time you're an economic influence, you become a political influence.
Do you think in general that if people in the bush request services from the state legislature, that the state legislature ignores them?
It depends on the request. Some cases they have completely ignored us. In other cases, they haven't ignored the rural communities, but said they would do something about it, and then haven't done it. And in some cases, they have gone out of their way to help. But in most cases, there seems to be a little antagonistic feeling towards rural communities, whether it's a backlash from the Land Claim Settlement Act with a fear of repercussion in the future or something of this nature. I think the feeling is unfounded, but nevertheless, there is a subtle feeling in that regard, I believe.
No, yeah.
Potlatch, produced in the studios of KUAC in College in cooperation with KTOO Juneau KLTC, Kotzebue, and KYUK, Bethel, under Title I of the Higher Education Act.